Thank you for joining us today. We'll begin by spending 10 minutes taking you through an introduction of the company. We have this presentation up on the website. And so we can spend 10 minutes just giving you a very quick overview of what we are. Unless if you say that you kind of broadly know us already, then we can skip the intro and go directly into question answers.
No, brief is fine.
Yeah, sure. So we started as an aluminium die casting company in 1985. Today we are the largest aluminium die casting player in the country. And also when it comes to two-wheeler, three-wheeler focused revenues, we are the largest in the country. Our products include, apart from aluminium die casting, suspensions, brakes and transmissions. All these are for two-wheelers and three-wheelers. We also are present into advanced electronics because this happened after we acquired Maxwell in 2022. And for four-wheelers, we are present in India as an aluminium die-casting company in India. And in Europe, we serve all the leading four-wheeler companies, Volkswagen Group, Stellantis Group, being our largest customers. We are also, it's not written here, but we are also into aluminium forgings and drive shafts. The financials, I'm sure you would be able to go through on our website. We have 19 plants in India and 12 in overseas locations. Most of these overseas plants are in Italy and Germany. We have R&D facilities, one for each of our products, suspensions, brakes, transmissions, aluminium die castings, and drive shaft. These are the five R&D centers in India. We have two tech centers in Italy, and we have a unique 29-acre proving ground in Aurangabad. We focus a lot on our R&D resources and capabilities. We've won 59 patents and 39 design registrations in our name. So in India, if you see, we have a leadership position in two-wheeler and three-wheeler, and we are building further on this leadership position. While we would like to capitalize and continue to grow in two-wheeler, three-wheeler domain, our focus is also to be strong in four-wheelers, EVs, and in the aftermarket. So currently, aftermarket is roughly 6% of our India turnover. We'd like to take it to 10% by FY28, and we have a plan for that. In the area of four-wheelers, our Europe business is focused on four-wheelers, like I said earlier. And in India business, we have a small part of our products going into four-wheelers. And currently, the consolidated turnover, out of the consolidated turnover, 27% is into four-wheelers. We'll be taking it up to 45% by FY30.
So that's largely, it will be Europe still, four-wheelers.
Europe and India. The growth will largely come from India.
Okay, in four-wheelers.
Yeah. Yeah, we have a very clean corporate structure. In India, we have the listed company where all the operations, literally all the operations except for Maxwell, is housed in the listed company. Maxwell is a company we acquired, like I said, for the advanced electronics business. Their key flagship product right now is the battery management system. We currently own 56% in Maxwell with a line of sight to go to 100% in 4 years. In Germany, again, we have a single operating company. And in Italy, we have an SPV, which has made a number of acquisitions over the years. The initial focus of the acquisition was to be casting and machining. The subsequent focus in the last 3 or 4 years is to leverage our two-wheeler capabilities in India and our companies in Europe, which would launch us into the aftermarket. So we're pretty strong now in the aftermarket in Germany and Italy. This we've already covered. This is our journey. So this is the fact that we IPO'd in 2016. And in 2019, the public now holds 25%. And 75% is held by the promoters. And these are the acquisitions, like I said. We've done a number of acquisitions. And Maxwell was acquired in FY23 by us.
Could you share a bit on the promoter background? Because suddenly there are two brothers. The other brother has Varroc Engineering as well.
That's right, yeah.
Relationship with Bajaj Auto. That you could help us understand.
Yes. So the business started in Aurangabad in 1985. Mr. Rahul Bajaj was Mr. Arunrang Jain's maternal uncle, his mother's brother. And when Bajaj Auto was setting up their Aurangabad facility, the brothers, Mr. Arunrang Jain and Mr. Tarang Jain, they were out of college and they wanted to kind of get into industry. This was an opportunity for them to set up a die casting company focused on Bajaj sales. Over the years, the businesses have grown both in size and in different product variety, the product basket has widened. And more than 20 years ago, the companies had kind of separated between Varroc and Endurance.
And Varroc is Pune based.
No, Varroc is also Aurangabad based.
Okay. They do have a plant adjacent.
No, they have 5-6 plants over there in, yeah, in Aurangabad.
And in Pune.
Oh. And in Pune, of
course. Yes. And, so, same yeah, as us, we too have plants in Aurangabad, Pune.
Okay. Okay. And product separation, like what is that Endurance focused on? What is Varroc?
No, first, now it's not that who focuses on what. We focus on our business model, they focus on their business. There's no interrelation, no.
There's no agreement as such.
Okay.
There's no overlap at all.
Okay.
Right? I think I would. The brothers have got an unstated understanding that we'll not be entering into each other's domain.
Okay.
So, if you look into the product verticals that we have got transmission, brakes, suspension, alloy wheels and castings.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas Varroc has got lightings and seats and electronics, valves and also. That is probably related to engine and the frame. This is related to the engine and, but with different components, different assemblies.
Right.
And your skill sets are different in terms of your more die casting.
No, I'd like to put it differently. Skill sets are dependent on the product that you hold.
Yeah.
Now, auto industry works on a set pattern. Mm-hmm. You know, you get RFQs, you've got PPAPs, you've got, you know, production schedules and so on. So it works in a way, and the quality systems are something same. Mm-hmm. So skill set on operations would be probably equal or, you know, in the same dynamics. As far as skill set for the product is concerned, they can be different.
Yeah, so I told you earlier that we are technology focused. We have a number of R&D facilities, and this roadmap gives us where and how we set up R&D facilities and how we collaborated with the best players worldwide to bring the technologies into India.
When you say R&D focused, what do you mean by that?
So we have more than 400 people working on R&D. Yeah, which includes product development, material analysis.
Now, let me put it differently. In order to hold your product vertical, first of all, you need to know that how you can scale upwards on your product,
mm-hmm,
and how you can meet the customer expectation from time to time.
Yes.
Now, if at all I'm holding a proprietary element, something like a shocker or a front fork, which is part of the suspension, I am fully capable of right from design till validation, mm-hmm, till service. Now, when I say service, so but you're only servicing these spare parts. We actually go down to the fields, understand how the end user is using our product, correlate that data to the testing that we do. We also go to the extent of having, you know, something like a road load data acquisition in which we instrument the vehicle in such a way that all the road load conditions, the actual conditions of the road are captured, and then you can transfer that to the MTS and other testing facilities and simulate the same road condition and road events onto the product. This way you'll come to know how the behavior of the product is while it's actually on road. So R&D doesn't mean that we are doing something only for a specific subject. It's a comprehensive plan to not only manufacture, but to always understand what's the field requirement, what's the customer requirement, how to upscale it also. So each R&D are self-sufficient as far as infrastructure is concerned, as far as people is concerned, as far as validation plans are concerned, and as far as field services and customer interface is concerned.
What's the R&D cost as a percentage of
revenue? In terms of percentages, we don't have a target in terms of percentages. It would be between 1-1.5% if I add both OPEX and CAPEX.
Okay.
Yeah. And then we have not shied away from making investments.
That's the right thing to say. Right. We've never shied away from making investments for R&D wherever it's a necessity. We've got even machines which are as expensive as 10 crores, 100 million rupees. And which is satisfying the product requirements for any kind of test requirement. Now, Endurance is probably the only tier one sitting in India who's got its own test track. That also implies that we are focused towards first time right products. So not only do we have our products tested on the lab, but we've got field conditions simulated on the test track and we we test the our products on the vehicles, on the actual vehicles on our test track. No?
Yeah.
So just to complete that question,
yeah, sure.
When you said that how much is our R&D spent?
Yeah.
So when I said test track, you know, we have spent, I think, more than 55 crores, which is 550 million rupees on the test track, which was not an immediate requirement. We could have had the requirement from outside. Yeah. You know, it was not a requirement by the customer also. But we did it for our own so that we can give first-time right products to the customer.
So that's true.
Okay. So our correlation of product validity and correlation with the customer, you know, validity, in case they're validating a product, they're checking a product, we're also checking it, we're testing it under similar conditions.
Yeah.
So our results do not vary. Yeah. So today the customers are so confident about our testing and validation that they know that we can deliver first and right product. Which they have.
Yeah, actually I'm aware of the road track actually. Mm. So there are inclines, there are patches, etc.
Yeah, that's right. So there are patches, there are inclines, there are speed areas where the surfaces for testing brakes are of high mu or low mu.
High mu, low mu, both.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, so this is largely for brake testing, which is
anything you can test suspension, brake, and transmission, clutches. See, the ramp over there, we've got five gradients over there, 4 degrees to 18 degrees.
This,
the B1. B1.
B1.
Now, 18 degrees is pretty steep for any vehicle to go up. But this is the kind of abuse we put onto the vehicle and see that is even if the customer requirement is generally 15 degrees, we are testing at 18 degrees also.
Mm-hmm.
So, even if we run short of, you know, testing on 18 degrees or some or 15 degrees, the customer is sure that we have tested it on a higher abuse.
So we are a complete solution provider because we partner with our customers in the design and development stage. Like Mr. Gyani talked about, the test track and our R&D facilities where we are able to test and validate our products in a very similar manner or in a tougher manner than what the customer would try to do. Our manufacturing facilities are state-of-the-art. We use a lot of POKI-OKs and cost-saving techniques there. And we are focused on delivering 100%, even in tough conditions. For instance, in the European fuel crisis, there were a number of our competitors who were not able to deliver products because of the costs going so much more higher. We made it a point that none of our customers had to suffer because of the costs getting escalated. Of course, we kept pushing them for cost recovery. And finally, in terms of aftermarket service, we have our own aftermarket. We deliver our spare parts to the OEMs as well. And if there is a field issue that the customer faces or the end user faces or the customer faces, we partner with the customer to identify what the issue would be. Our traditional products, you can say, are in four categories. First is aluminum die casting, which includes alloy wheels also. And then we have suspensions, which is the front forks and the rear suspensions, the rear shock absorbers. We have the transmission products, which are the clutches. And we have the discs, where we make the entire disc assembly ourselves, which includes the disc, the hoses, the master assembly, the caliper assembly, as well as the ABS. ABS is one of our recently added products. Similarly, drive shafts are recently added. The battery management systems, which we've launched with after the acquisition of Maxwell, that's our product. Forgings, we started as a backward integration project, but now we are also selling to OEMs. Brakes, we have been traditionally doing brakes for lower CC vehicles up to now we are capable of doing brakes for higher CC vehicles and have done supplies. And our EV castings, which were up to maybe 2 or 3 years ago focused on ICE vehicles, we do a lot of EV parts now. And also for non-auto applications. So we currently have orders in generator sets. We have orders in cell phone towers. And in Europe, we have certain orders in the industrial applications.
Could you talk about your market share on the legacy products first and then the recently added ones?
Sure. So we are close to 40%, I'll give you exact numbers. We're close to 40% in suspensions and brakes. In castings, it's very difficult to tell you market share. Reason being, the casting is a highly fragmented industry. But we know we are the largest aluminum die casting player in the country. And in clutches, our market share is lower. In terms of competition for clutches, we have two Japanese companies which have a presence in India. That's FCC and XED. In brakes, FCC. FCC.
And
XED.
XED.
Yeah. Yeah. In suspensions, our competition includes Gabriel, Showa, Munjal Showa. And in brakes, the competitor is Grimeca. So Grimeca is an Italian company with presence in India.
So there's no domestic competition apart from Munjal Showa, which is
Munjal Showa, and Gabriel is also.
Gabriel is over
there. It's an Indian company.
Yes, yes. Okay. It's a listed company.
Yeah. Gabriel. Okay. And brakes, Grimeca is an Italian. Casting, you said, is
Brembo. Grimeca is not a competition. Grimeca is owned by us.
Yeah. Sorry, I meant Brembo. Sorry, Brembo is an Italian company.
Brembo.
Yeah.
Brembo.
VRE.
MBO.
Okay. Yeah.
Brembo.
What's been happening to your market share in these areas over the last, let's say, 5 years? How's that?
In brakes, we have seen an increase in market share. We've put up our second plant because we've added new customers. We've seen ourselves go up in terms of more than 200cc.
Mm-hmm.
And we've also launched ABS. Yeah, so in brakes, there's a sharp increase in market share. Also in alloy wheels, we've seen an increase in market share. In aluminium die casting and suspension, I think we've been growing, but not as sharply as...
Let me put it this way.
Yeah.
Let me put this. We have been growing very sharply in suspension also.
Mm-hmm.
The vehicle configurations have changed, you know, from normal conventional forks. It is changing to inverted front forks, which is upside down forks. There our market share is the highest, right? 40,000, yeah, close to 40,000 inverted front forks every month,
mm-hmm.
which was... probably 4,000 in a year, 10 years back. You know, we had this, let me explain it further. The first ones to launch an inverted front fork in India was Endurance with in collaboration with WP Suspension. Then WP Suspension, now it is KTM Components. The bike which was made over here was Duke 200 and others. So that's where it all started. And today we are manufacturers, or we are just launching the world's largest front fork of 48 dia for 48 dia inner tube.
Mm.
Now, front forks are measured by, or the sizes are measured by its tube. Mm. So, 48 dia is the largest size in the world. Okay, but where have we? We have got a range right from 26 dia till 48 dia. Mm. So, we've been growing, you know, substantially in suspension as far as high-end bikes are concerned. Like in Triumph, we're single source to that.
Mm-hmm.
In KTMs, we're single source to that. So, these are the numbers which are growing up in comparison to anything. So when it comes to inverted front fork, all the OEMs look at Endurance as the first option.
Mm-hmm.
So market share in alloy wheels, there's a good share.
Alloy wheels, again, it's difficult to tell you. I at least don't have it right here.
I can tell you one thing, that we have got a capacity of 190,000 sets, mm-hmm. which is already declared, and we are scaling up to 230,000 sets of alloy wheel, mm-hmm. which is in numbers, you can say 460, and in total annual, it is 5.5 million. So if the total requirement would be, let's say, 21 million vehicles are being made, scooters do not have alloy wheels, so let's remove 5 million vehicles. Like, I'm just going by my mental math, so don't hold me for the exact numbers.
Yeah.
So 21 million is something that we are expecting in a year. So 5 million goes from scooters because they are not 100%, so that's 16 million. All of them are not alloy wheels, okay? Yeah. Around 15 million or 14 million are alloy wheels. So that makes 28 million, out of which we are doing 5.5. Okay. So that's the mental math behind the market share.
Trust.
Okay, I hope.
That answers. And competition?
There are many competition people.
China.
We've always got China as a competition. We've got China based in India as a competition. We've got Minda. We've got Minda and Enkai.
Minda, sorry?
Enkai.
Enkai.
Yeah. Enkai.
Thank you.
So when I say there are many players, I still believe that we are the dominant ones who are holding a very large share in aluminium for two-wheeler applications. Now, Enkai is into four-wheelers also. We are not there.
Uh-huh.
Minda is probably into four-wheelers. We are not there. So segments are different, but I think we are one of the dominant players of two-wheelers.
None of the products seems that they'll be impacted from the electric vehicle transition, but correct me if I'm wrong. So if you could help me from this product basket.
The clutches will.
the clutches will. Two-wheeler and three-wheeler, these are wet clutches. And electric vehicles do not have wet clutches.
Okay.
So that will be impacted, which is just about 4% of our total turnover.
Yes.
So if it's impact to business, it's not as much.
Mm-hmm.
But even if you look that how the vehicle configurations will change, because EV is also on its evolution stage. Right? It's still, the final configuration is still not on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody's still making those market acceptable products that where do they attract the target audience
mm-hmm.
to buy the best EV. So even the people are evaluating which is the best EV. The OEMs are also, in my opinion, are looking into the best configurations. So I strongly believe the clutch will not be there, but there will be a transmission system which will play a role.
But transmission is majorly into motorcycles where EV penetration is slower relatively.
No, again, scooter, there will be a transmission. Yeah. There will be a transmission system in which there will be some change point on how to increase speeds and other things. So some transmission with gears and other things would be there. But clutch as such will not be there. So there will be no wet application.
Okay.
Yeah, but Sagar, you're right. When you say that today in endurances, clutches, out of the 4% of our revenue, 3% goes into motorcycles. Maybe only 1% goes into three-wheelers.
Okay.
So the motorcycle where the pace of electrification is slow, we don't see the clutches going away immediately.
In fact, it's in
three-wheelers. Yeah. In three-wheelers, yes, we are seeing rapid electrification.
And just to add to that, scooters are having CVTs as the transmission. Which does not have clutch. It has a CVT.
Yeah.
We are not there in CVT. So if you look at the impact on my business, it's not going to be as high or as substantial that may look or optically you may find, oh, if everything converts into EV, what happens?
Yeah.
Nothing much happens to endurance because scooters, there's no clutch. We are not there. CVT is there on a scooter. We are not there. So it doesn't impact us even if the configuration of the vehicle changes over there.
Yeah.
In fact, in our existing business, the BMS, which is an EV-focused product, yeah, it has much higher potential than the clutch, which would go away because there would be
retraction. In BMS related question, what exactly happens within the business? I know it's a small part of business, so it's not a, you know, for as an analyst, it's
no,
not
so when does it do you mean
to analyze? Yeah, so I want to understand.
So BMS or any embedded electronics, so these kind of products, they are expected to read signals, process those signals using past algorithms, and determine what actions need to be taken and trigger those actions. So what the BMS would be doing is looking at the state of charge, state of power in each cell of the battery and processing that information, keeping in mind the structure of the vehicle, the weight of the vehicle, the expected range of the battery and things.
Energy like that. Consumption on... See, BMS is one of the most important elements for an electrical vehicle, vehicle. It not only controls, but it also signals what should the vehicle do in case of events. For example, if the temperature is going high and there are 200 cells. So the BMS will have an algorithm which will say, okay, cell number 21 and 22, please do not draw current. No?
Okay.
Of course, the word please will not be there. Algorithm will say.
It's algorithm. We can be gentle and in terms of BMS, no one has the kind of experience that Maxwell has on Indian roads. Maxwell has been on Indian roads for 5 years or 6 years now, and more than 150,000 BMSs are running on roads.
But Maxwell BMSs are running. OEMs might be having in-house capacity also, I guess.
Some OEMs are doing it in-house, yes.
So is there a, over kind of risk to it?
There's no risk to it. See,
yeah.
Let's go 30 years back. Okay. Just to explain the point of today. Let's go 30 years back when the OEMs were doing a lot of work in-house. Okay. They were even making clutches. They were doing suspension in clutches and many things were done in-house. Now, outsourcing model was becoming important and became prime for the OEMs. Today, what they do in-house is only probably final machining of the crankcase. Finally, that too, in our case, we are doing most of it. So the operations in-house have gone all outsourced. That's why you see that the capabilities and competence built up with the tier ones and tier twos has become so strong that the customers are now fully dependent on them. So it's not a one-way dependence now. It's a two-way dependence. If the OEMs want to make a vehicle, they've got to depend on the tier ones and tier twos who've got the capability of making these important elements of the vehicle. Like suspension, they will not go back.
Yeah.
The expertise lies outside. Initially, since the vehicle model was totally changing. There was no engine, right? EV doesn't have an engine. It has different other things, battery and, you know, motors and other things. So in order to have more and more homework done, this is my assumption on, you know, more and work done and more, you know, IP gets into it. The OEMs have probably kept this in-house. But in the long run, I strongly believe that all this is again going to be outsourced.
So what's the CapEx requirement for OEM if it, they have to, you know, put up a capacity for this? Capacity as in a BMS facility for
this. I wouldn't have a number to that. I wouldn't have a number that how many.
It is more about the algorithm than the software. So what we brought from Maxwell did not include any machines or things like that. Mm-hmm. The machines or the test masters were very small equipment.
Okay.
The product or what we bought along when we bought Maxwell, what came along with it was the algorithms. The fact that they had worked on and hardware designing. So it was these design aspects that came with Maxwell.
It's more an electronic component, right?
Yes, it's an electronic component.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a different business.
Yes, it is, because that comes under embedded electronics.
Yes. Yeah.
So that's totally electronics. What we manufacture is mechanical stuff. For example, a suspension is mechanical, a brake is mechanical. But now what's happening? The electronic instruction to mechanical things is happening. You know, and electronic instruction is going down to the brakes that please apply brakes.
Yeah.
You know, that's the ABS, what the ABS does. Electronic instruction is going down to the engine. So a lot of ECUs are talking to a master ECU.
Yeah.
Mm.
And that's how the configuration is changing. That means electrical elements are totally different than the mechanical elements.
In fact, for endurance, the first electronic product was not BMS. The first electronic product was ABS. Yes. Because like I said, these electronics are supposed to read signals. So the ABS reads the wheel rotation signals and processes the information and using its algorithms determines how much brake oil should be released or pumped.
So, actually, I have few specific questions. I fear that we may not run out of time.
Yes, we might. But yeah, please go ahead with your question. I'm sure you... ...also benefit.
25% to 45%. Now, are we in touch with any of the OEMs like we have not catered to in past? Like Maruti, for, you know, supplying any of our products, mainly aluminium castings, forgings. So that is one. And secondly, in FY25, can we see some trajectory moving towards 45% mark, right, from 25% currently? What's your view on that?
Yeah. So again, if we take you back a few years. Yeah, when we were looking at our growth path, we saw that there was still a lot to do in the two-wheeler, three-wheeler domain. Firstly, there were customers who were not in our fold. For instance, TVS was not in our fold at that time. And with people like Hero, Honda, we were quite small. We didn't have sizable orders from them. So our focus at that time was to continue to focus more on the two-wheeler, three-wheeler segment. Yeah, we've achieved a lot there. We've added all traditional OEMs are our customers. A number of new age EV OEMs are our customers. And using this momentum, we are confident that we would be able to penetrate all major customers in the two-wheeler, three-wheeler space without enormous focus going into this area. So with bandwidth being available and with our growth aspirations, our financial wherewithal, and our understanding of the four-wheeler industry through castings, whether in India or in Europe, we are big in four-wheelers with in India with Tata, Mahindra, Hyundai, Kia, and in Europe with all the kind of main continent players. Yeah, now of late we have also got an order from JLR. So you can say with European OEMs and Indian OEMs, we have a strong presence in castings. With Maruti, while we have a vendor code with them and we were supplying a small part, but what we have seen is that they tend to buy raw castings and not machined castings. In the process, we've also not focused very hard in that area. Yeah, we would like to penetrate Maruti as well. They are no doubt large. As more and more electrification happens, the fact that for all the EV-related casting parts, Yeah, we've got a lot of experience over the last 2-3 years in Europe because we've been supplying to EV and hybrid for more than 2 years now in Europe. Almost 3 years now we've been supplying these parts. So as these become more mainstream in India, these vehicles, EV-related vehicles, we feel we would have the advantage of having our European operations guide us for quicker launches.
So
that's on the casting side.
Yeah.
The forging side, we are still not there in four-wheelers. Yeah, we've got the JLR order. The production hasn't started yet. In forgings, for us, forgings as such is a new product. Around 2 years ago, we started forgings for our backward integration. But we have a strong technical partner from Italy, from where we are getting the technology. And the process is absolutely stabilized for these two-wheeler applications. For four-wheeler applications, we would be kind of investing more and doing more forging parts as well. Yeah, parts like BMS, parts like drive shaft, these are, and alloy wheels, these are, you can say we have the internal capabilities in two-wheelers and we have to take this forward to four-wheelers.
Yeah.
And in parts like suspensions and brakes and clutches, we would have to engage with technology suppliers. So this is the roadmap for our existing products. And we are in talks for either M&A or a JV or a technical collaboration so that we can launch newer products. So the focus, which up till now, or rather 3-4 years ago, the focus remained key. Let's continue to hammer at the market where we already are strong and there is much more room to kind of deliver more. From there, we've seen that now we've hit a place where the momentum should take us. Of course, it will need focus, but not the kind of focus it needed 4 years ago. And we can focus on the four-wheeler area.
So on these products which you talked about, like alloy wheels, BMS, suspension, which would be, I mean, we are supplying first time for, you know, these products will be supplied for the first time for to four-wheeler owners,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
So have we like started the talks? That's what my question was. Existing OEMs, not Maruti specifically, that was just an example, like we have not been catering to them. So for the existing OEMs...
For certain products, yes, we are in talks.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what's the approval cycle from their side? Even if suppose they kind of do the test, what's the process basically before approving what they check?
First of all, the approval process for all products is different. A suspension product, the time of, for approval would be different. For the engine components, it would be different. So it depends where do we get the breakthroughs. So according, like in castings, engine castings, the first thing that is tested is an engine. So the lead times of developing an engine is far more than the lead time of developing a suspension. So it depends where brakes would take the entire corner module, you know, on a four-wheel. The entire corner module will have to be checked in one go. They can't test the suspension separately and the brake separately.
Right.
So what I understand from the four-wheeler industry and validation process is that the entire corner module would be checked for the entire vehicle. So unless until all the parts are not ready, they will not be able to start testing.
Can we expect something from, FY25, like supplying these products to, starting to supply these products to the existing?
Forgings, we would be able to start, yeah.
Forgings.
Yeah. Okay.
Even castings? Castings are already there.
Yeah, already.
New product.
But it's a small percentage, right?
No, you can't say small.
7-8% of total.
That way.
Yeah,
but
total.
No, but within the India casting business, it's around 25-30%.
Yeah, India casting business, it must be. So when do we start supplying brakes and suspensions and...
Why did you say that?
Too early to say that. It would involve a joint venture or a collaboration agreement or an M&A. Yeah. So we have the focus, we have the financial wherewithal.
And in terms of the margins, how it would be different for the similar products?
We have always said that margins have to be made by producers. I mean, a customer would want to give orders at very low margins. Yeah, it is our abilities and the abilities of our supply chain that will enable us to make the margins. So
where I was coming from is that the realizations are different when you cater to four-wheeler, right? And the product specification technically may be different. So in terms of supplying to two-wheeler versus to four-wheeler, is there a margin difference?
Our aspiration is to maintain our margins.
Okay.
Yeah, we are not looking to change the margin profile from a 14% to a 20%, nor are we going to grow our top line at the cost of margins. So that's our philosophy.
Your business is not a margin of
reduction. I mean, it could, if we get similar margins, I think we will aim for both.
This transition to focus on four-wheeler increasing products or cross-sell these products to a four-wheeler, did this come by because market has sort of peaked? Because it used to do 24 million in two-wheelers, now to 20 million.
In a way, what you're saying is right. I won't say the market has peaked. What has happened is that earlier, I mean, if you see 2-3 years ago, invariably two-wheeler growth was faster than four-wheeler growth.
Yes.
So now we are seeing intermittently, in fact, out of the last 8 quarters, maybe in 6 quarters, four-wheeler growth has been higher than two-wheeler growth. Yeah, so that has certainly played a role in our decision to focus on four-wheelers apart from kind of consolidating our presence in two-wheelers.
You see the market going back to 25. I know you have some thoughts last I interacted in a good discussion that 24 million will not happen.
I said that, okay, pre-COVID, 24.4, I still remember that number so very well because I've spoken about it so many number of times. 24.42 million vehicle was the peak. And recently I told everyone that, you know, all the industry pundits way back in 2013, industry pundits means the one who are experts on this industry, they said that the peak expected was 29 million, 29 to 30 million. Today, that has not happened. The best that we could reach is 24.42. Today, even while we are talking about 2030, still people are at the same number, 29 million or 30 million. So I'm not saying that it has peaked out at 24. I still see that there's a headroom. What is this transition that is happening right now is the vehicle configurations are changing. The target audience expectations are changing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you see that the premiumized vehicles are selling more, that means the disposable income available at the end user is higher. People will not settle down for 100cc bikes no more unless until it's a mere requirement of the farmer or people who are graduating from bicycles to motorcycles. That will grow, but not that exponentially as it used to. I believe the premium bikes will go up as the vehicle configurations moving towards more safety features, moving towards more vehicle stability features. That will keep on going up. So the upside has still not touched.
Yeah.
There's still headroom.
We are still at pre-COVID. We are still to touch a pre-COVID level. So what's your expectation on F25, like in terms of the volume? That was actually my question.
That I think the best people who've done such surveys are the OEMs themselves. So this question should go to them. I will follow them as far as my capacities are concerned.
But looking at the outlook, since you're in touch,
I always say people who have a negative view on two-wheeler market growth, you should go to the wholesale markets in any town in India.
Mm-hmm.
And you see how many people come there by four-wheelers and how many streets or shops have the ability to park four-wheelers, zero almost.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, you see a number of people coming in two-wheelers. So if somebody has to upgrade in India, people talk about the fact that people are now moving from two-wheelers to four-wheelers. Yes, there are some families which will not buy a two-wheeler, they'll go straight to a four-wheeler. But it's not just that 5 lakh rupees of extra expense on buying the car. One has to think of the parking space back at home and at the workplace. So you're looking at somebody who's better off than he was, at least to the extent of 20, 30 lakhs. Only then he can think of moving from a two-wheeler to a four-wheeler.
Yes, we're talking about a two-wheeler recovery, like all the OEMs were talking
about.
Yeah,
they're doing good.
Yeah, and quarter-on-quarter we also saw some kind of stabilization. Now, if you look at the industry, especially with the transition going on, all electric coming for an IPO, etc., how do you see growth in the India business, and then can possibly talk about the Europe business later on?
Growth in the India business is, there are 4 or 5 pillars that we work on strengthening. One is more customer connect. Yeah, so like I told you, all the traditional OEMs in the country are our customers. In the EV space, we have Ather, Okinawa, Hero Electric, Greaves. These are the major customers. And people like Ola, while we don't have orders from them yet, but we have a strong connect with them already.
Okay.
So that's the first pillar. Target more and more customers. Then cross-selling. Like if for TVS, we began with brakes, then now we've already added suspensions, castings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and therefore, and drive shaft, alloy wheels. So there are multiple products that would go into customers. So wherever we are present strongly in one, then we also want to be strong in other areas. Yeah, so
that's some headroom for us to grow in our existing business itself. Like To give you a flavor, it's not happened so far, but I can give you a flavor that what can be the growth driver.
Hmm.
So far, ABS has been used only up to 150cc bikes. But one or two OEMs have used it on vehicles below that also. I've seen an ABS on 110cc bike also. Okay. So if the regulatory requirements change, that an ABS should be there on all vehicles, that's the upside.
Yes.
For that, we already have the product. It's just upscaling.
Yeah. We expect that to happen near time.
Why not? Yeah. Why not? See, let's go again. Would you buy a car for yourself today without an ABS application? You cannot, because the variant is not available. The variant itself, yeah, except for an Alto or something, I think there the ABS is not there. But anything above that, 1200cc or 1200, everyone has got an ABS. So it's a standard feature. So if ABS has to become a standard feature on two-wheelers, then growth is, you know, defined for us.
For us, competition in ABS, we didn't discuss that, is Bosch and Continental.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're talking about ABS and the future products. Your question also was around that. In ABS, we had a capacity of 400,000, which was full up with single-channel orders from Bajaj and Royal Enfield. And we have now expanded the capacity to 640,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
And we are also in touch with the customer to develop a dual-channel ABS. So that's another area of growth. With this experience that we are developing in electronics, whether it's BMS or ABS, we would be able to do more electronic products. So our suspensions, where we sell certain suspensions, where at the flip of the switch, you can change the damping force. So if you're off-roading, you were off from the highway and off-roading, you would have to flip a switch right now. And there would be electronic variants to that. So that's also a future product for us. In clutches, we are not very strong in the 200cc plus motorcycles. Our subsidiary in Italy has been supplying these clutches, which are called assistance slip clutches, to the Italian market. To people like KTM, they have been supplying these clutches, and we would like to launch these into India as well.
That technology is very much developed and well ahead in testing with our customers.
Yeah, so these are in aluminium forging, we have got a couple of third-party orders. Otherwise, our capacity is largely being used for internal use. But going forward, we see a lot of potential there. Apart from the fact that we have a strong technical partner who is able to share the right technology with us, we must also recognize that we are among the largest buyers of aluminium in the country. So when we buy aluminium and buy scrap in large volumes, and we've been doing that from 1985, so we've built a lot of expertise on the buying side as well. That gives us an edge over competition.
Just on the electronic side, as we go more EV, more and more components have an electronic edge. Where does that go? Where do you see this going in 5 years' time in terms of new components, new electronic components, or putting electronics to existing components?
Suspension may have some electronic variants,
mm-hmm,
right? See, first of all, electronic components can only happen on high-end bikes. I don't think anybody would want to have electronic configurations for bikes which are being sold in rural areas. First of all, the end user will not understand what to do with it. Secondly, if he buys a vehicle like that and he's unable to understand, he's stuck up on a road, he would be in problem.
Deep trouble.
So he would not do that because the understanding level is different.
Yeah.
So electronics taking over all on bikes on a 100% basis, that's not going to happen. Unless the OEMs have got a different configuration in mind, I don't know. But large part of electronics will happen when all these elements start talking to each other through a central ECU. Through a central ECU. Then all the mechanical elements will be controlled on its speed, variations and other things through electronic media only.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where high-end and premium bikes will come into place.
And are you ready for that transition?
We've embarked on this. Mm-hmm. For example, we have embarked on BMS. That means the embedded electronics team is there, where we've got more than 150 engineers working on BMS right now and other things. But in order to have other features ready, we can leverage their presence with us. And now since BMS or this Maxwell is our own company, we can utilize the resources in different ways.
And as backward integration within electronics, we were depending on third parties to doing the surface mounting.
So the move into e-four-wheelers in electronics, where does that come in terms of your ability to take electronics on scale?
No, we still have to tread on that path. Yeah. I don't think we are ready for four-wheeler applications on electronics.
Okay. Yeah,
in the BMS area, we're doing some small four-wheeler applications, small forklifts and things like that. Mm-hmm. So that's something that we've done. But those are not very complex applications. When it comes to complex on-the-road vehicles, we have to move that journey. So
our business model did not start that way on four-wheelers. Mm-hmm. See, as Raj explained very well earlier, there was a lot of headroom available in two-wheeler and three-wheeler, which we had to encash on and create that space for us. Mm-hmm. Today, we are a dominant player on brakes. We are a dominant player on suspension. We are a dominant player on castings. So our dominance is visible.
Yeah.
As far as four-wheeler is concerned, you can see our presence, strong presence on castings. So while we embark on the journey of other products on four-wheeler, this will be the beginning. And we know that while we embark on that, there will be a lot of electronic capability that we will have to build for ourselves. So it's a progressive business model.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say that we have been left behind. No, it was not designed that way.
Say 9 months FY24, so like broadly we have, you know, kind of done a revenue of 4,800 crores from two-wheeler segment. So of this 4,800 crores, what part of revenue comes from plus 150cc bikes?
I don't think
we don't have that breakup.
I don't have to that number that how much comes from that's a good question.
Yeah,
I'll put in some numbers to it.
Why I was asking this is because we want to understand the trends on premiumization that we are playing as an endurance. So if suppose the revenue number is significant, that gives us a hint that premiumization part of endurance portfolio is more.
But then what my request to you would be, yeah, that don't look at 150cc bikes, because they were never premiumization bikes. 150cc Pulsars and were available even 20 years back. Premiumization is what? 350cc, 250, the new configured 250cc's, you know, which is coming with new elements. That's premiumization. 350, like a 400cc Dominar, a 400cc Triumph. These are premium bikes. Duke 400 are premium bikes.
But talking about numbers, if we just speak about products,
yeah,
inverted front forks. 4 years ago, we only had Bajaj and KTM as our customers. Today, we have more customers. I think Hero.
We've got Hero. We've got
HMS.
HMSI.
And TVS also. I think.
No, TVS.
Taking orders. Okay, not yet. Yeah, so these are there. In alloy wheels, Bajaj and Yamaha used to be our customers 4 years ago. Now we've added Royal Enfield and TVS.
Okay.
On brakes, Bajaj was not buying less than 200cc brakes from us. Now they're buying in that category.
No, they were not buying more than 200cc bikes.
Sorry, up to 200.
Yeah, up to
200 they were buying from us. Yeah, so there are products that we have launched in the last 3 to 4 years which have helped us penetrate more in the 200cc plus.
But offline or in the presentation from next quarter onwards, I would appreciate if you can add that number, because it becomes a significant, you know.
Yeah, I can tell it to you, yeah, but if you adding that number onto the website may not be a question of all. You get my point.
Yeah.
It's your question.
Yeah.
Do you really want to see that segmentized? Then probably we'll have to put in another something, you know, some.
Or maybe you can share with me offline.
No, we can. I mean,
it's not that
if we have the number, we can share with everyone. That's not the.
But it's a good problem. Question.
Yeah.
It opens my, you know, antenna also that, okay, how much am I growing? See, I've been looking at macro level, which is amply clear.
Yeah.
That, you know,
yeah,
if Triumph, I'm a single source, if, you know, on all 350cc bikes of Royal Enfield, you know, I'm almost single source.
Yeah. And if 150 you want to call premium, sorry, if 150 you want to call premium, then 4 years ago there was zero ABS. Today we are more than 400,000 units of ABS.
Yeah. So one interesting point, you know, to make here is that, you know, motorcycle segment as a whole, you know, it's struggling to grow. Yeah. Within the two-wheeler segment. Of course, scooter is a small segment for us. At one end, this point is there, and the second you know, and a lot of premium products are getting launched. 350cc, 440, right? So that's where I'm coming from, you know, when the premiumization segment increases, yeah, within the motorcycle segment, and mass market is totally different from a premium market. So we saw that in SUV segment during the COVID times, right? So that's where I'm coming from, that how it could impact us if the premiumization plays out, right, within the motorcycle segment. Are we looking at the growth from, you know, endurance perspective? That's where I was coming from.
Well, to answer your anxieties, I would say, in spite of the auto industry having done 3 or 3.5 million vehicles less than the peak for which I had capacities.
Yeah.
You know, if we have made 24.42 million and today we are at 21, that means I had capacities at that time. So my performance has to be measured from 24.42 or even more because I had capacities beyond that. In spite of 3 million vehicles or 3.5 million vehicles not being there on the road with the same level, we are still growing. So that's an indicator of the fact that I am growing higher than the industry. So even if the industry is not offering me that volume, I'm still growing. And how am I growing? The actions and strategies that I've placed many years back are playing out now. Okay, so this is on a backward and forward integration both. My actions and strategies were such that it protects my business even today.
Even the strategies that you laid out, which is cross-sell, customer connect, was all independent of the industry.
Yes. Yes.
What do you foresee in the next 3 to 5
years? Yeah, so further strategy to that would be value addition, like we discussed, being there in the entire chain. So we want to be there in the 100cc boxes in a big way. We want to be there in the 440cc or in the 1290cc also for the KTM. So that is also one of them. Sorry, what was the question?
Internally, how do you strategize the next 3 to 5 years on this growth?
That's still in our boardroom discussion.
We look at product-wise strategies, we look at customer-wise strategies, we look at new product strategies. So, I mean, there are many legs to the strategic growth.
It's part. Like industry plus X percent growth, that is, that we can use some route.
You can't fix a plus, you know. Industry plus is, yes, acceptable.
Yeah.
Industry plus, how much, that I can't put a number to that.
Okay.
So there we have to go model by model.
Mm-hmm.
So in TVS, what are the expected launches? Yamaha, what are the expected launches? Bajaj, what are the expected launches? What is the what are the products that we aim to get?
Okay.
What's the expected success rate? Stuff like that. Yeah. I don't know if you're aware about the fact that many of our plants are in Aurangabad, and that's a backward area as far as classification of the state is concerned, which means that the government of Maharashtra kind of pays back the entire capex that we spend. So in 2013, the Maharashtra government had said that if you spend 250 crore in the next 6 years, yeah, then you get the entire capex back. We spent 466 crores. Out of the 466 crores, we have booked in our P&L statement, we have booked incomes of 383 crore. And we've collected cash of 242 crore. Yeah, so half of, or rather, 200 crore more has to be collected over the next 3 to 4 years from the state government of Maharashtra under the 2013 scheme. Now, under the 2019 scheme, the government had said that if you spend 350 crore over the next 5 years in that region, you get the capex back.
Mm.
Our spending is, we are kind of tabulating, and the period is not yet over, but we can assure you that our incentive collection from the state government would be more than what it was in the 2013 scheme. Yeah, so we are still to make that full application, because once the period is over, we have to aggregate the capex spends and fill up the forms and send it to the Maharashtra government. But we are confident that we would be also getting the eligibility certificate under the 2019 scheme, which means, and this is a 7-year income booking formula that the Maharashtra government has used.
And they give you back cash at the end of the scheme. Is that how
we
do it?
No, they give us cash after we finish sales in Maharashtra,
yeah,
where the Maharashtra government earns GST.
So it's a state GST. It's a state GST which gets offset.
Right, okay. So they have to earn the money and then they get it.
Yes.
So, so in terms of the gross margin, so we, you know, pre-COVID levels, and also when the RM cost was not as high as today it is,
yeah,
like, we were clocking up gross margins of around 42-43%.
So you're saying
42,
58% RMC. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So 42.5-43% was the range of the gross margin.
Yes.
Currently, it is around 40% range.
Yes, we've seen a 4% drop.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're right. So there have been commodity increases.
Yeah.
And when commodity prices increase, although we are able to pass it through, but because of the denominator effect. So though we are making the same margins, but we are making it on a higher sales value because we passed through some material costs.
Arithmetic effect.
Arithmetic effect. So that is one of the impacts. And then there are certain other costs, not only for us internally, but for our suppliers as well, whether it's energy, whether it's minimum wages in the country, those have gone up. The OEMs don't have an automatic formula for giving us this price increase.
So how can we see the EBITDA margins getting back to, say, 14% range, like it used to be, 14-16% range?
16 is something we are not expecting in the near future. 14 is something that we don't give forward-looking numbers as such, but I mean, we've done 14 for a consistent, for a pretty long period of time.
Yeah.
And while OEMs don't pass through minimum wages or energy-related costs, but most of our OEMs are fair customers. So over a period of time, they do give us increases for considering the fact that we've seen increasing costs.
So the margin trajectory would improve.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm not asking for the number, by the way. It's just a trajectory I was asking about.
Yeah. Similarly, in the European business, where we were doing 18% for a consistently long period of time, we were down to 11% when the energy costs shot up, and we are back at around 15.5%.
Okay.
Yeah, there we see further increase from 15.5% because the energy costs have softened. Our new product pipeline is strong. So in Europe, yes, there's a concern around volumes because European economy, they're not used to such high inflation numbers, and a lot of cars do get sold on mortgages, and so people borrow to buy vehicles. And if that is the situation, then at least in the lower segment cars, we expect the market to be muted. But for us, the positive part is that if we see our steady state turnover, our average turnover for the last 5 years, it would be close to 250 million euros. Yeah, which was largely coming from ICE vehicles in the past. We made a big shift towards EVs and hybrids. Today, if we aggregate the peak revenue expected from all the EV and hybrid orders, we are more than 240 million in that range we are. So you can say we have already booked orders to reach the turnover, which we are currently doing mostly through ICE. In the future, if we don't get any further orders also, we should be at that turnover through EVs and hybrids.
And what's the general outlook in Europe, if you can share some views on?
So this interest rate and inflation is a worry factor. Energy is no longer such a big worry factor.
But new car registrations, are they like improving?
Yes, they are improving
Yeah.
from last year, but last year was a very bad year.
Yeah.
So if you look at 2019, which again for them also was a good year, last year they were down 33%. Now I think they are down around 20%.
One last question, if I can just
squeeze.
So, you know, a lot of order execution would happen in F25. Not quantitatively, I'm asking, but generally, F25 should be better year with this launch.
We think
Is
so.
It
In
fair
fact,
to
we've
say?
given, in our presentation, how we expect new orders to ramp up, but then how much of OEM's existing volumes will get cannibalized as new vehicles come in, that is something we are not aware of. And I mean, the OEMs are also not aware of as to when people buy their new models, to what extent their existing models would get impacted. So that's a judgment call we have to make individually as to how much we would have lose revenue, but there is a path for growth in revenue. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the answer.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. And just one request, you know, plant visit, just,